13-year-old ninth graders as it had been to some Manhattan Project scientists, who also had the opportunity to form their judgments before the bomb was used. The one with the earliest experience of recording such a judgment was Leo Szilard, who first conceived and patented the idea of a chain reaction in a heavy element like uranium. He was in London in 1933 as an émigré, having left Berlin just days after the Reichstag fire earlier that year, anticipating the Nazi dictatorship that would quickly emerge and foreseeing the subsequent European war. On March 3, 1939, Szilard was the first person to see the flashes on an oscilloscope screen confirming his suspicion that neutrons were emitted in the fission process of uranium, and this in turn would mean that the large-scale liberation of atomic energy was just around the corner. He reports his reaction. "We watched them, the flashes, for a little while, and then we switched everything off and went home. That night there was very little doubt in my mind that the world was headed for grief." Nevertheless, later that year, expecting imminently the war he had long foreseen and fearing that Nazis might be first to exploit the potential of nuclear energy in a bomb, it was Szilard who induced Albert Einstein to send a letter, which he co-drafted, to President Franklin D. Roosevelt, urging what came to be the Manhattan Project. It was dated August 2, 1939. Hitler invaded Poland on September 1st. Almost 3.5 years later, Szilard and Enrico Fermi constructed the first working nuclear reactor, which was necessary for the production of plutonium for a bomb. The Germans never did get a reactor to work. On December 2, 1942, Szilard recounts in his memoir, "A chain reaction was actually initiated and controlled for a very brief period at Stagg Field on the University of Chicago campus. Someone brought out a scarce wartime bottle of Chianti, and most present celebrated and congratulated Fermi." Szilard reports, "There was a crowd there, and then Fermi and I stayed there alone. I shook hands with Fermi, and I said I thought this day would go down as a black day in the history of mankind." Yet despite this extreme and fully justified foreboding, Szilard was playing a critical role in bringing this ominous explosive power into the world. How could he? The answer is that he believed, even before others, that they were racing Hitler to the attainment of this power. It was German scientists, after all, who had first accomplished the fission of a heavy element. There seemed no reason to suppose that Germany could not stay ahead of any competitors in harnessing this unearthly energy to Hitler's unlimited ambitions for conquest. The specter of a possible German monopoly, even a temporary one, on an atomic bomb drove the Manhattan Project scientists. Above all, the Jewish émigrés from Europe like Szilard. Fermi had left Italy in 1938 because his wife was Jewish. Until the day of Germany's surrender. In reality, the race was one-sided. At virtually the same time in June 1942, that the American team of theoretical physicists was tackling the problems of bomb design, Hitler had decided against a bomb effort, not for moral but for practical reasons. The unlikelihood that it could be delivered during the several years he had scheduled for the war. Nevertheless, ignorant of this German choice, the scientists in the United States focused single-mindedly on achieving a usable weapon as quickly as possible. Some of them saw it exclusively as a means for deterring Hitler from using such a weapon if he got it. To possess such a deterrent seemed an urgent necessity, raising no moral issues for them. One of these scientists, Joseph Rotblat, after learning from a British associate in the fall of 1944 that there was no German program to deter, promptly resigned from the Manhattan Project. The only scientist to do so, Rotblat was induced, by threat of deportation, not to reveal his reasons for leaving, lest he inspire others to emulate him. Others, including Szilard, remaining uncertain whether Hitler might unveil this war-winning weapon at the last moment, were prepared to use the weapon against Germany if it became available before Nazi surrender. But prior to that event, there had been almost no consideration or discussion within the Manhattan Project itself of what to do with or about this capability if it were not needed either to defeat Germany or to deter a German bomb. Only after this was unmistakably clear with the German surrender did Szilard and some of his colleagues turn to urgent efforts to avert a unilateral U.S. test of the bomb, or to refrain from dropping it on Japan, thus hoping to avert an inevitable U.S.-Soviet nuclear arms race. But it was too late. We come at last to the issue with which I began this chapter. The reasons for my own lower-level involvement in shaping nuclear policy, despite my early feelings of dread about the very existence of nuclear weapons, were strikingly similar to those of Joseph Rockblatt and Leo Szilard. In the late 50s, I was given what seemed good reason to believe, on the basis of highly classified official information, that we were again in a desperate race with a powerful totalitarian opponent comparable to Nazi Germany, working to deter a nuclear Pearl Harbor attack, or to avert unanswerable nuclear blackmail. As we'll see, once again, this apprehension was based on illusion. But the fears were real, and they seemed to have a plausible basis. How I came to share these fears and to act on them is a story with two parts. First, like my older colleagues at that time and like so many among my generation in America, I had become a cold warrior over the preceding decade. I had taken some note when Churchill, one of my heroes since the Battle of Britain, proclaimed in March 1946 that an Iron Curtain had descended across the continent, dividing free Europe from tyrannical rule in the East. Less than a year after the defeat of the Nazis and their Japanese allies, he pointed to totalitarian control by Moscow of nearly all the capitals of Central and Eastern Europe, except, he said, Athens. It was to preserve precisely that exception that Harry S. Truman, the following March, called on Congress to supply aid to Greece, whose monarchy was facing a communist-led insurrection. My awareness of post-war foreign policy really began with this announcement of the Truman Doctrine in the spring of 1947, my junior year of high school. Truman proposed U.S. readiness to support free peoples anywhere from the imposition of totalitarian regimes, a phrase he used four times in his speech. The phrase conveyed an essential equivalence between communism and Nazism, and between Stalin and Hitler. It implied that the challenge we faced in World War II had not really ended in 1945. As a child of that war and trusting Western leadership, I accepted that definition of the challenge, and at 16, too young to have taken part in the earlier campaign, I was ready to rise to it. As I followed the news in subsequent years about the communist coup in Czechoslovakia in 1948, the Berlin blockade later that spring, the Stalinist regimes and political trials in Russia and Eastern Europe, and later the North Korean attack, I came gradually to accept all the Cold War premises and attitudes. Looking back, the key premise was the equation of Stalin and his successors to Hitler. This was first of all in their internal totalitarian controls and ruthless repression of dissent, where the analogy, especially under Stalin, was valid. I've never lost my well-founded abhorrence of the domestic tyranny of Stalinist-style regimes, whether in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, China, North Korea, Vietnam, or Cuba. More problematic in retrospect, in fact I would now say flat wrong, recklessly so, was the presumption that such regimes, like Nazism, had an insatiable appetite for expansion, which they were determined to satisfy by military aggression where necessary and feasible. In particular, it was presumed that the communist regimes in the USSR and Eastern Europe, now armed with nuclear weapons as well as superior conventional forces, posed a direct military threat to Western Europe and America even greater than Hitler's. Moreover, the equation of communist regimes with Hitler ruled out any attempt at meaningful negotiations for the resolution of conflicts or arms control. Nothing other than full military preparedness for imminent warfare could influence or contain the Soviet threat to the free world. By the time I prepared to enter college, I was beginning to see myself, as I did for many years afterward, as a Truman Democrat, a liberal Cold Warrior, pro-labor and anti-communist, like Senators Hubert Humphrey and Henry Jackson, and like my Detroit hero, Walter Reuther of the United Auto Workers. I admired Truman's action in sending bombers filled with coal and food instead of weapons to resupply the people in Berlin during the Soviet blockade that began the month of my high school graduation. I supported his response 2 years later to naked communist aggression in Korea. And I especially appreciated his decision to keep Korea a limited conventional war, rejecting General Douglas MacArthur's recommendations to expand the war to China and to use nuclear weapons. Believing in the policy, I was prepared to go to Korea myself, though I had no eagerness for it. After accepting student deferments until I finished Harvard, and then for a year's graduate fellowship at Cambridge University, I felt an obligation to take the place that others had filled for me. On my return from Cambridge, I volunteered for Officer Candidate School in the Marine Corps in the fall of 1953. The first opening was the following spring. When my 2-year obligation in the Marines ended in the early summer of 1956, I requested Headquarters Marine Corps to extend it for up to a year, because my unit, 3rd Battalion, 2nd Marines, in which I had been a rifle platoon leader, a battalion training officer, and a rifle company commander, was headed for a tour of sea duty in the Mediterranean with the 6th Fleet. Gamal Abdel Nasser, the president of Egypt, had just nationalized the Suez Canal. With the Suez crisis looming, we had been alerted that our seaborne battalion might be in a war. I had just been awarded a 3-year term as a junior fellow in the Harvard Society of Fellows, but I didn't want to see the troops I'd trained and commanded go into combat without me. When headquarters granted my request to extend, I turned down the fellowship and went to the Mediterranean with my battalion. This decade of ideological immersion as a Cold Warrior was a necessary part of what prepared me for the next decade of work as a government consultant and official on national security. But that wasn't what drew me to visit or then join the Rand Corporation in Santa Monica in the late 50s, thereby launching me on this career. As I knew, Rand did mostly classified research for the Air Force, largely on the use of nuclear weapons. Nothing could have repelled me more. It was true that my 3 years in the Marines had left me with new respect for the military, especially the infantry, and with a greater readiness to apply intellectual concepts to problems of military strategy than I would have felt otherwise. But to work for the Air Force? On nuclear bombing plans? I'd picked the Marines to join over the Air Force very consciously because the Marines didn't bomb cities and had virtually nothing to do with nuclear weapons. In any case, for years prior to my coming to Rand, I had expected to pursue an academic career as an economic theorist. On leaving the Marines in the spring of 1957, I had reapplied and was accepted in the Society of Fellows. It was perhaps the best postgraduate fellowship in the country, designed as an alternative to a Ph.D. For 3 years, junior fellows could pursue whatever line of study they wished, without supervision, with an office, research, and travel expenses, and the salary of a Harvard assistant professor. They weren't allowed to take courses for credit, and in that period were not encouraged to write a Ph.D. thesis or to get the degree. I knew what I wanted to work on. Ever since my senior year in college, I had become fascinated with the new field of decision theory, the abstract analysis of decision-making under conditions of uncertainty. For my degree in economics, I had written my senior honors thesis on the question of how to describe and understand, and perhaps to improve, the way people make choices when they are uncertain of the consequences of their actions. That included situations of conflict in which the uncertainty partly pertained to the choices of a rational adversary, the subject of so-called game theory. In the fall of 1957, I began to focus on choices in situations of extreme uncertainty, which I termed ambiguity, sparse information, unprecedented or unfamiliar circumstances, lack of reliable frameworks for understanding processes, conflicting evidence or testimony, or contradictory opinions of experts. A great many situations had some or all these characteristics, military political crises in particular. I felt that existing theories of appropriate behavior, rational choice, in these circumstances were inadequate, in fact misleading, and I set out to demonstrate this and to invent better ones. I was also interested in the role of threats, which I felt that, along with uncertainty, most economists analyzing bargaining theory had long neglected. Partly because all this had relevance to military decisions, one institution that had shown a special interest in such subjects was RAND, where mathematicians had made basic contributions. It was RAND's unclassified publications on decision theory that interested me, not its defense work, whatever that was. In August 1957, at the end of a summer studying mathematical probability theory at Stanford University, I paid a visit to RAND, which led to an invitation from its economics department to spend the following summer there as a consultant. I accepted solely for intellectual reasons. Neither I nor anyone else, as far as I knew, had any sense of an impending nuclear or Cold War crisis that month. That was shortly about to change for the public. But that change had already occurred, as I later learned, for the people in the RAND Economics Department. They had taken special note of something that hadn't yet drawn major attention outside the Department of Defense. A claim by the Soviet Union on August 26th that it had successfully tested an intercontinental ballistic missile, ICBM, at full range. On the basis of secret intelligence information they couldn't share with me when I visited, the economists at RAND knew that this claim was true. 2 months later, on October 4, 1957, when I was back at Harvard, the whole world learned about Sputnik, an earth-girdling artificial satellite sent up by the Soviet Union, which began broadcasting its beep-beep signal. It was a technical achievement that the United States was not immediately ready to match, and the global presumption of U.S. technical and scientific superiority was shattered. Though Eisenhower decried the concern about this new object in space, as he said publicly, "It does not raise my apprehensions, not one iota." It actually did imply that Americans in the continental United States were becoming vulnerable in a way that had never been true in our previous history. By placing Sputnik in space orbit, the Soviets dramatically supported their claims 2 months earlier that they had rockets of intercontinental range. As it happened, Project RAND's first reports to the Air Force back in 1946 and 1947, when Project RAND, embryo of the RAND Corporation, was part of Douglas Aircraft Company's engineering division, had been a proposal for a world-circling spaceship which could be in orbit by 1952. The project reports had foreseen the political impact. The psychological effect of a satellite will in less dramatic fashion parallel that of the atom bomb. It will make possible an unspoken threat to every other nation that we can send a guided missile to any spot on Earth. But at the time, General Curtis LeMay, then in charge of development for the Air Force, was far more attracted to threatening other nations with high-flying bombers than with missiles, and the proposal wasn't funded. While the United States rushed its program to put something up in the fall of 1957, the Russians sent up their second, much larger satellite in November, this time with a dog, Laika, aboard. This second Soviet launch with a much larger payload, lofted like the first by their initial ICBM engine, demonstrated that Soviet rocketry had achieved both the thrust and the accuracy that could send missiles with thermonuclear warheads to targets in the United States within 30 minutes of launch. The next month, a vast global audience watched on television as an American missile rose 4 feet in the air, then sank back and exploded on the pad. The nose cone, with a miniature satellite aboard, detached and fell into surrounding brush, its little radio still beeping. "Someone should put it out of its misery, shoot it," an observer suggested. Newspapers derided Flopnik, Stayputnik, and Kaputnik. The first successful U.S. ICBM test at intercontinental range came in November 1958. By this time, the national mood had changed abruptly. During the summer of 1958, while I was at RAND, the Eisenhower administration had found itself forced to respond to the humiliating Soviet lead in space by creating the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, in the Defense Department, and the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, and the National Defense Education Act, spending $1 billion to improve science and mathematics education. For my part, when I arrived in Santa Monica in June as a summer consultant, what I had found myself addressing was not, after all, decision theory or bargaining theory in the abstract, but concrete decisions on which the future of peace and national or even human survival seemed to depend. How to deter the Soviet Union from exploiting its apparent superiority in missile capabilities to attack or coerce the United States? The summer of 1958 was the high point of secret intelligence predictions of an imminent, vast Soviet superiority in deployed ICBMs, the missile gap. But even before those predictions, top-secret RAND studies over the previous 4 years had concluded that the ability of the Strategic Air Command to retaliate against a Soviet surprise attack against our strategic bombers was far from reliable. These studies found great vulnerability even on the basis of Soviet bomber capabilities, which turned out later to have been greatly inflated by intelligence predictions of a bomber gap, which preceded the missile gap estimates. Earlier studies assumed only a minor role, if any, for Soviet ICBMs and submarine-based missiles. But the addition of even 20 to 40 Soviet ICBMs ominously enhanced the possibilities of a disarming surprise attack. And 30 ICBMs were the lowest near-term estimate for Soviet missiles in the more recent RAND studies. The estimates by the Air Force and CIA of near-term Soviet ICBM forces looked toward several hundred, perhaps as early as 1959, with a crash effort, almost certainly by 1960 to 1961, with thousands in the 60s. Eisenhower's reassurances and apparent calm about the challenge seemed to confirm the notion of him as a retired grandfather, out of touch with reality, focused only on his golf game. That was the image shared by everyone I came to meet at RAND. It was paired with the notion that our own sponsoring organization, the Air Force, which certainly didn't underrate the prospect of a vast Soviet superiority in ICBMs, didn't seem able bureaucratically to rise to that threat in an appropriate or effective way. That is, it was resisting or dragging its feet in adopting the recommendations that RAND had been making for several years at this point, and which seemed all the more urgent after Sputnik. To my new RAND colleagues, the projected Soviet ICBM buildup looked unmistakably like an urgent effort, with a startlingly high chance of success, to acquire the capability to disarm SAC's power to retaliate. Such a Soviet capability, and even the costly crash effort to achieve it, destroyed the basis for confidence in nuclear deterrence. At least it did for anyone reading these studies who shared the widely accepted Cold War premise that the Soviets aimed ultimately at world domination. That included everyone I worked closely with at RAND. And in light of both the intelligence estimates that became available to me as I acquired security clearances, and the views of my highly intelligent colleagues, it came to include me. Within weeks of my arrival in 1958, I found myself immersed in what seemed the most urgent concrete problem of uncertainty and decision-making that humanity had ever faced, averting a nuclear exchange between the Soviet Union and the United States. On the basis of the RAND studies, the challenge looked both more difficult and more urgent than almost anyone outside RAND seemed able to imagine. In the last years of the decade, nearly all the departments and individual analysts at RAND were obsessed with solving the single problem of deterring a Soviet nuclear attack on U.S. retaliatory forces and society in the next few years and beyond, by assuring that a large U.S. ability to retaliate with nuclear weapons would survive any such attack. The concentration of focus, the sense of a team effort of the highest urgency, was very much like that of the scientists in the Manhattan Project. And the center of this obsessive ideation was the Economics Department, which I joined. In my first week as a summer consultant in 1958, I was assigned to be the rapporteur of a discussion group on responses to the strategic threat, which included Albert Wohlstetter, Harry Rowan, Andy Marshall, Alan Enthoven, and Fred Hoffman, the key strategic analysts in the economics department, as well as Bill Kaufman from social science and Herman Kahn from physics. From my academic life, I was used to being in the company of very smart people, but it was apparent from the beginning that this was as smart a bunch of men as I had ever encountered. That first impression never changed, though I was to learn in the years ahead the severe limitations of sheer intellect. And it was even better than that. In the middle of the first session, I ventured, though I was the youngest assigned to be taking notes, and obviously a total novice on the issues, to express an opinion. I don't remember what it was. Rather than showing irritation or ignoring my comment, Herman Kahn, brilliant and enormously fat, sitting directly across the table from me, looked at me soberly and said, "You're absolutely wrong." A warm glow spread throughout my body. This was the way my undergraduate fellows on the editorial board of the Harvard Crimson, mostly Jewish like Herman and me, had routinely spoken to each other. I hadn't experienced anything like it for 6 years. At King's College, Cambridge, or in the Society of Fellows, arguments didn't remotely take this gloves-off, take-no-prisoners form. I thought, I've found a home. And I had. I loved Rand, where I ended up spending 10 years, in 2 hitches, the second when I came back from Vietnam in 1967. Much, I imagined, like members of a religious order would, I shared with my colleagues a sense of brotherhood, living and working with others for a transcendent cause. In fact, those former Manhattan Project scientists who stayed on in weapons work, as well as their successors at the nuclear weapons labs, are often described by others, not admiringly, as a secular priesthood. In part, that's a matter of their knowledge of secrets of the universe, arcana not to be shared with the laity. The sense of being an insider, the seductions of secrecy, to be counseling men of power. An article on the new military intellectuals likened Rand consultants in Washington and the Pentagon, moving invisibly across bureaucratic boundaries opaque to others, to the Jesuits of old Europe, moving between courts, serving as confessors to kings. But above all, precisely in my early missile gap years at Rand, and as a consultant in Washington, there was our sense of mission, the burden of believing we knew more about the dangers ahead, and what might be done about them, than did the generals in the Pentagon, or SAC, or Congress, or the public, or even the President. It was an enlivening burden. Materially, we led a privileged life. I started at Rand, just out of graduate study, at the highest salary my father had ever attained as a chief structural engineer. Working conditions were ideal. The climate was that of Southern California, and our offices were a block from the Santa Monica Beach. But my colleagues were driven men. They shared a feeling, soon transmitted to me, that we were in the most literal sense working to save the world. A successful Soviet nuclear attack on the United States would be a catastrophe, and not only for America. It was taken for granted that at some Russian equivalent of Rand in the Soviet Ministry of Defense or Strategic Rocket Forces, a similar team was working just as urgently and obsessively to exploit their lead in offensive forces, if not by a surprise attack, then by compelling blackmail against the United States and its NATO allies. We were rescuing the world from our Soviet counterparts, as well as from the possibly fatal lethargy and bureaucratic inertia of the Eisenhower administration and our sponsors in the Air Force. The work was intense and unrelenting. The Rand building's lights were kept on all night because researchers came in and out at all hours, on self-chosen schedules. At lunch, over sandwiches on courtyard patios inside Rand, we talked shop, nothing else. During the cocktail interval at the frequent dinners that our wives took turns hosting, 2 or 3 men at a time would cluster in a corner to share secret reflections, sotto voce. The women didn't have clearances. After the meal, the wives would go together into the living room, for security reasons, leaving the men to talk secrets at the table. There were almost no cleared women professionals at RAND then. The only exceptions I remember were Nancy Nimitz, a Soviet specialist who was the daughter of Fleet Admiral Chester Nimitz, Alice She, a China analyst, and Albert Wohlstetter's wife Roberta, a historian who was then working on a study of how the Japanese had achieved a surprise attack on our Navy at Pearl Harbor and our Air Force in the Philippines in December 1941. Her draft findings, which we all read intensely that summer, greatly influenced our thinking and our anxieties, as a premonition of exactly what we were trying to prevent. My first summer there, I worked 70-hour weeks, devouring secret studies and analyses till late every night, to get up to speed on the problems and the possible solutions. I was looking for clues as to how we could frustrate the Soviet versions of RAND and SAC, and do it in time to avert a nuclear Pearl Harbor, or postpone it. From the Air Force intelligence estimates I was newly privy to, and the dark view of the Soviets, which my colleagues shared with the whole national security community, I couldn't believe that the world would long escape nuclear holocaust. Alan Enthoven and I were the youngest members of the department. Neither of us joined the extremely generous retirement plan RAND offered. Neither of us believed in our late 20s we had a chance of collecting on it. I remember one August night in particular, sitting in the office assigned to me, which looked out over the ocean. It was a moonless night, close to midnight. The ocean was dark outside my windows. I was reading an analysis of the optimal conditions from a Soviet point of view for a surprise attack. A key point, I read, would be for them to accompany ICBM and bomber attacks on SAC bases deep in our interior, with carefully coordinated attacks by cruise missiles from submarines onto bases near our oceans and on command centers, outflanking our radar in the north, and providing no warning, with only minutes of flight time. Since their submarines had to be on the surface for this, and considering various weather conditions, the ideal time for the attack, I read, would be in August, about midnight on a moonless night. I looked out the window at the blackness of the sea. Then I glanced at my watch. I literally felt a shiver, and the hair on my neck rose. In the circumstances described by these studies and by intelligence estimates, especially those of the Air Force, deterrence seemed imperative and uncertain. According to these top-secret estimates, we faced a powerful enemy making costly efforts to exploit the potential of nuclear weapons totally to disarm us and to gain unchallenged global dominance. No non-nuclear U.S. military capability could promise to survive such an attack and respond to it on a scale that would reliably deter an enemy so determined and ruthless. Nothing could do so other than a reliable capability for devastating nuclear retaliation, capability that would assuredly survive a well-designed nuclear first strike. As Wohlstetter emphasized in his briefings to the Air Force, our ability to deter a Soviet attack on the United States was not measured by the scale of our offensive forces in place before the war, but by what the Soviets could foresee would be our second strike capability to retaliate to their first strike. How much survivable destructive capacity would it take to deter them? That would depend on the circumstances and the alternatives, Wohlstetter suggested. Any potential alternatives to the Soviets' own first strike might, at a particular moment, look very ominous to the USSR. Perhaps crushing defeat in a regional war, or a possible U.S. first strike in escalation of a conflict in Europe. Like us, the Soviets might be presented with a choice among grave risks. In the conclusion of RAND's top-secret vulnerability study, R-290, of which he was the principal author in 1956, Wohlstetter asserted that our then-programmed strategic force cannot ensure a level of destruction as high as that which Russia sustained in World War II, a destruction from which it has more than recovered in a few years. This is hardly the crystal-clear deterrent we might need in some foreseeable circumstance. The implication, never questioned by anyone at RAND while I was there, was that adequate deterrence for the United States demanded a survivable, assured second strike capability to kill more than the 20 million Soviet citizens who had died in World War II. That meant we were working to assure the survival under attack of a capability for retaliatory genocide, though none of us ever thought of it in those terms for a moment. Truly, in view of my strong feelings against the indiscriminate bombing of cities by both sides in World War II, there was a terrible irony to my working for the Air Force on studies aimed at threatening the Russians with the ultimate in terror bombing if they should attack us. But there was a consistent logic to it. From the analyses by men who became my mentors and closest colleagues, I had come to believe, like Szilard and Rotblat a generation earlier, that this was the best, indeed the only way, of increasing the chance that there would be no large nuclear war in the near future. When my former Harvard faculty advisor heard in 1959 that I was going back to RAND as a permanent employee, he told me bitterly that I was selling out, as an economist, for a high salary. I told him that after what I had learned the previous summer at RAND, I would gladly work there without pay. It was true. I couldn't imagine a more important way to serve humanity. Chapter 2. Command and Control. Managing Catastrophe. For my own contribution at RAND, reflecting my long-term focus on decision theory, I chose to specialize in a subject that seemed up to this point understudied in relation to its importance. The command and control of nuclear retaliatory forces by senior military officers, and especially by the President. Most of my colleagues were studying the vulnerability, and how to reduce it, of strategic nuclear weapons, bases, and vehicles. I joined a few others who were examining the vulnerability and reliability of the military's nervous system, command posts, information and decision-making processes at different levels, communications, warning systems, and intelligence. It was widely accepted that the decision whether and when to initiate launch of U.S. nuclear forces against the Soviet Union, under any circumstances, should be made by the President, or the highest surviving authority. How he might arrive at that decision and how it would get implemented were concrete questions that demanded highly secret empirical knowledge. Nevertheless, I was especially drawn to study this particular command problem not only because of its obvious importance, but also because it exemplified and drew on everything I had analyzed in my graduate study of decision-making under uncertainty. It would be the transcendent and conceivably the last decision under uncertainty ever made by a national leader. Moreover, in my initial reading of the key RAND study R290, Protecting U.S. Power to Strike Back in the 1950s and 1960s, a word leaped out at me that had been the focus of my own thinking at Harvard that year. Ambiguity. The study, whose principal author was Albert Wohlstetter, alongside Harry Rowan and Fred Hoffman, noted that some of our plans depended on our having strategic warning of an imminent enemy attack, an intelligence warning received prior to any enemy weapons having been launched against us. But planning on strategic warning is dangerous, and this cannot be overemphasized. If we are to be realistic and accurate before the event, the most positive answer we can ever expect to the question, "Are the Soviets going to attack us?" is perhaps. And the answers to the other important but vexing questions, when and where, will be even more uncertain. The real question, however, is not only how early we will have these signals, but how unambiguous they will be. We can state unequivocally that they will be equivocal. The ambiguity of strategic warning complicates the problem of decision. No other formulation of a decision problem, this one the most important in human history, could have caught my attention so forcefully. Ambiguity was not a term then used in academic discussions of risk and uncertainty. I was especially struck to see it in a classified study because I was in the process of introducing it academically as a technical term, referring to subjective uncertainty when experience was lacking, or information was sparse, the bearing of evidence was unclear, the testimony of observers or experts was greatly in conflict, or the implications of different types of evidence was contradictory. I conjectured, as was later borne out in many laboratory experiments, that such uncertainty could not be represented by a single precise numerical probability distribution, either in subjects' minds or as reflected in their behavior, even though they did not regard it as totally uncertain. The uncertainty of strategic warning described here seemed likely to fall into that category, and Wohlstetter went on to point out that the same problem arose even in the context of tactical warning. Indications from long-distance ground radars or infrared satellites that enemy planes or missiles had left their launch sites, headed for the United States before any of them had arrived on target. The radars of the Arctic Distant Early Warning Line, DEW Line, had more than once, I soon learned, been fooled by a flock of high-flying geese into warning that Soviet bomber planes were coming toward us over the North Pole. In the pre-ICBM era, that still allowed hours in which to discover the error, and meanwhile to get our planes on alert off the ground. But just a year after I joined RAN, the higher-tech radar and computer system, Ballistic Missile Early Warning System, BMUSE, designed to detect incoming ICBMs, in its first week of operation reported that a missile attack was underway. That called for decisions in under 15 minutes. On October 5, 1960, some of the highest industry officials associated with the Air Force's technical systems, including Tom Watson, head of IBM, were visiting North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD, inside Cheyenne Mountain, Colorado. Pete Peterson, later Nixon's Secretary of Commerce and at this time Executive Vice President of Bell & Howell, was sitting in the commander's chair on the command balcony confronting the huge world map. That bit of role-playing was a little treat for honored visitors. In his book, Command and Control, Eric Schlosser tells what happened that day, pretty much as I heard it at the time, as highly classified gossip, along with everyone else working on the issue. The first BMUSE radar complex, located at Thule Air Base, Greenland, had come online that week, and the numerical threat levels of the new warning system were being explained to the businessmen. If the number one flashed in red above the world map, unidentified objects were traveling toward the United States. If the number three flashed, the threat level was high. SAC headquarters and the Joint Chiefs of Staff had to be notified immediately. The maximum threat level was five, a computer-generated warning with a 99.9% certainty that the United States was under attack. As Peterson sat in the commander's chair, the number above the map began to climb. When it reached four, NORAD officers ran into the room. When it reached five, Peterson and the other executives were quickly escorted out and put in a small office. The door was closed, and they were left there believing that a nuclear war had just begun. One of the businessmen in the room, Chuck Percy, then president of Bell & Howell, and later a three-term senator from Illinois, recalled a sense of panic at NORAD. That's the way I heard the story that month, from Air Force colonels. Contrary to Pentagon assurances when word leaked out that the warning hadn't been taken seriously. One thing that led some at NORAD to find the warning somewhat more ambiguous than the computer's 99.9% certainty was that Khrushchev was in New York for the United Nations that week. It turned out that the BMUSE radar signals were bouncing off the moon as it rose over Norway. The designers, as I heard it in the Pentagon, had figured that the radar would reach the moon, but they didn't think the return echo would be so strong as to look like incoming missiles. Everyone makes mistakes. What impressed me while reading Wohlstetter's passages above was not only that he had directed attention to the ambiguity of warning, he had also pointed to the cognitive and behavioral effects of this ambiguity. It would inevitably delay responses by the various command levels, as it should, and by the president himself. In the era of missiles, a delay of minutes could mean the destruction of a retaliatory capability, along with the commanders. But what were the president or lower levels of command to do, on the basis that perhaps an attack was on the way? or even on 99.9% certainty from a computer program that might possibly be overwrought. Wohlstetter had successfully proposed a way of increasing the survivability of alert bombers on the basis of ambiguous or equivocal warning, without committing us to war. Albert took credit for originating the positive control process as a partial answer to the problem of false alarms and poor information. This introduced a launch-on-warning, low option, with respect to bombers that was separable from the decision to execute the war plans, in other words, to send the bombers to target. The planes launched on warning under positive control were to fly to a pre-designated rendezvous area, where they would circle unless they got an explicit positive order to execute, that is, to proceed to pre-designated targets, or an order to return to the base. If they received no order at all, they were to return to their base at the point when they had just enough fuel to do so safely. This option doesn't exist for operational ballistic missiles, which can't be recalled once launched. President Reagan once made a public statement to the contrary for submarine-launched missiles. He really may not have known better. This is a dismaying confusion for a president to suffer. But how reliably were these safeguards observed in actual practice? No military secrets were more tightly guarded than the details of how, by whom, and under what circumstances decisions to execute nuclear war plans, both planes and unrecallable missiles, would really be arrived at and implemented. An opportunity to study these in the field with high access, though not at the president's level, arose a few months into my research. The Commander-in-Chief, Pacific Command, SINCPAC, Admiral Harry D. Felt, called for a study of his problems of nuclear command and control in the Pacific to be done by the Office of Naval Research, ONR. I was glad to have Rand lend me to the study. In the fall of 1959, I moved to Camp Smith in Oahu, Hawaii, SINCPAC headquarters, to join an ONR study group headed by Dr. John Wilkes. I didn't agree to stay for the whole year since my wife wasn't prepared to move the family there with me, so I went for several months at first, then came back repeatedly during 1960 to help the group in the later stages of their study. Much of our work was at the headquarters of SINCPAC and of the Pacific Air Force's PACAF on Oahu, but we made extensive field trips throughout the Pacific Theater. I observed operations and held discussions with commanders, planners, and operators in almost every command post in the Pacific. The basic problem that SINCPAC most wanted our team to focus on was how to assure, if and when a decision were ever made to use nuclear weapons, that his own execute message ordering the implementation of nuclear war plans would get out to the various forces in the Pacific in a reliable and timely way. This would have to be done before various command posts, communications in the theater, or his offensive forces were destroyed by a Soviet attack. But a problem that I took on personally to investigate was the obverse of that one, reducing the possibility of unauthorized action. How to assure that no subordinate would be inclined or able to launch the forces under his control in the absence of an authorization from his superiors or the president? In principle, unauthorized action was simply forbidden. According to all the top-secret war plans, an execute order at any level of command to carry out a nuclear war plan had to be based on an immediate, explicit order from higher authority, ultimately from the president himself. However, there were provisions in the plans for taking various preparatory actions on local authority, and even for launching planes on warning of imminent enemy attack, to protect them from destruction. This was Wohlstetter's positive control process. Such a launch was not supposed to be tantamount to a decision to execute a war plan, to proceed to targets. This procedure was also known as failsafe. If there were a failure from the base to transmit an intended signal, either to go ahead or to return, the planes were to act as if they had gotten a return signal. This response might be an error if there was actually a war on and communications were destroyed, but it was a safer error, less dangerous, than the mistake of going to target when no war was going on and communications were out for technical or atmospheric reasons. The term positive control and its synonym fail-safe procedure meant that the pilots were to be trained and drilled to understand that they were never to go to target under any circumstances without a positive order, explicit and immediate, from a higher authority to do so. And an execute order had to be authenticated as coming from the highest authorities, meaning it had to be accompanied by coded evidence and to come in such a manner that made its origins at the highest levels unmistakably clear. But how reliably would their behavior conform to these instructions? How safe was this process really? I had raised this question in the very first memo I had written on a Defense Department contract, just a month after I had come to the RAND Corporation as a summer consultant in 1958. It was titled, Strains on the Failsafe System, and it was addressed to Wohlstetter, the author of the Failsafe Procedure, and to Frank Eldridge, the leading communications expert at RAND, one of the RAND analysts I had consulted. It reflected my own experience, ending just the year before in a highly disciplined organization, the Marine Corps, and my reading of military history. I was aware that the behavior of conscientious officers would reflect not only what they had earlier been told to do under prescribed conditions, but also their sense of the mission and their actual beliefs about the current situation, based on their immediate experience and observations. To paraphrase my memo, what I foresaw was that the lack of a positive order to execute, following an order to launch that was accompanied or followed by strong signs of an enemy attack, would itself inevitably be ambiguous. Perhaps no less so than the tactical warning that gave rise to the launch. The lack of any signal might mean that a return to base was desired. It was certainly supposed to be responded to as if it surely meant that, according to the written rules. Nevertheless, it might mean that an order to execute had been sent but had not arrived yet, and might not arrive in time for it to be carried out with the remaining fuel, or that it would have been sent and received had not the enemy nuclear attacks wiped out the commander or the transmitter or interfered with the transmission. It could, in other words, be a very ominous indication, depending on what other evidence was available. For example, how often had pilots had the experience of getting to this point, of circling in a rendezvous area, without receiving a message to return, and without, as it turned out, their base having been under attack? Ever? If the whole procedure were practiced often enough up to this point, the pilots would come to expect that on any given occasion, in the absence of any other evidence, that they were taking part in a drill. They would have acquired a habit of returning. They wouldn't feel any pressure to break that habit, to disobey their standing orders and to take off for their targets, even if they got no further orders. They would return to their base routinely. But as I conjectured at RAND, and as I discovered when I was able to investigate this question in the field, in our SyncPAC study group, it was not at all clear that most pilots in the Pacific got a chance to acquire such a habit. In fact, although we heard different opinions on this, it seemed very unlikely. As our group actually witnessed on a visit to Kadena Air Base on Okinawa, the first part of the launch-on-warning procedure was practiced frequently, in fact daily, at random times, up to the point when planes were ready to taxi for takeoff. At Kadena, the pilots weren't continuously in the alert planes or in the alert hut on the strip. They were allowed to be elsewhere, at the PX or in their quarters, each with his individual jeep and driver, because they practiced the alert at least once a day. The officer in charge told our research group we could choose the time for that day's rehearsal. When our leader, John Wilkes, said later, "Okay, now." The klaxon sounded all over the area, and almost instantly jeeps appeared on all the roads leading to the strip, rushing around curves, with pilots leaping out as they reached the strip and then scrambling into the cockpits, still tightening their helmets and gear. Engines starting in 10 planes almost simultaneously. 10 minutes. That drill assured that the planes would be ready to take off in time when ordered. At that, practice had made perfect. But the later part of the exercise, to assure that they would fly to their rendezvous area and eventually come back from it, unless they were ordered to proceed, was much more time-consuming and expensive in fuel and maintenance. It was obvious that it would be practiced much less often. We asked, was it ever rehearsed at all? Answers on that were vague and conflicting. It was understood that SAC, which had invented this procedure, did do full-scale rehearsals of it frequently, but it was not clear that theater forces ever did. In fact, we learned at Kadena that the tactical alert planes there never actually left the ground in their daily drills. And that wasn't just for reasons of expense. They were barred even from taxiing from their alert pads to the point of takeoff. The reason, we were told, was the danger of accident, possibly a nuclear accident. Each of the alert planes, single-person F-100s, was carrying a Mark 28 thermonuclear weapon outside the plane, beneath the undercarriage. These weapons, we were told, were designed to be carried inside a plane for greater safety. But there was no room for that in these tactical fighter bombers. Moreover, they were not one point safe. All H-bombs, thermonuclear fusion weapons like these, were triggered by a plutonium bomb of the type that destroyed Nagasaki. The plutonium core was surrounded by a spherical web of shaped charges of high explosive. When all these detonated simultaneously, they imploded the plutonium core inside, squeezing it to a density of greater than critical mass, leading to a nuclear fission explosion that in turn triggered the thermonuclear fuel. One point safe meant that the design ensured that if one of the high explosive shaped charge sections exploded accidentally, no significant nuclear yield would result. Or more precisely, there would be a less than 1 in a million chance of a nuclear yield greater than 4 pounds. Only if more than one went off, from being dropped, burned, or fired into, or from an electrical malfunction, might there be a partial nuclear explosion. That might be on the scale of the Hiroshima bomb. Since these weapons were not one point safe, there was a danger that if they were dropped or involved in a crash or a fire or an explosion and one or two sections of the high explosive detonated, it would mean not only the dispersal of radioactive contamination from the plutonium trigger over a large area, but also a possible partial or total nuclear explosion. While the probability of the latter was small, the risk was not worth taking in a practice drill, which, after all, happened once a day. Therefore, in these practice alerts, the pilots would jump into their planes and gun up the engines. But they didn't go to the point of racing down the runway or even taxiing over to the runway from their pads, let alone taking off. When they were not on alert, the pilots, of course, often flew their planes without weapons. And apparently they also did training missions with actual weapons when not on alert. But we found it hard to get a clear answer whether pilots on actual standby alert ever took off in a practice drill from their alert pads with weapons aboard. Certainly not very often, if ever, we were told. Probably never. That said to me that if they were ordered to take off from those pads, it would be an extraordinary, perhaps unprecedented experience for the alert pilots, even if it was in fact unknown to them only a drill. The first time or two that it happened would almost surely lead them to infer that this was it. An enemy attack was underway, or else they were leading a preemptive strike. At least they would have to infer that the indications of enemy attack were more serious than they ever had been before. It would be in that state of mind that they would head for their rendezvous areas, even if they received no execute order to follow their launch order. This particular consequence of the lack of regular rehearsal of takeoff under fully realistic simulated alert conditions didn't seem familiar to any of the nuclear control officers or pilots that I questioned. In fact, they all admitted that it had never occurred to them. They all seemed to hear my reasoning as new, interesting, and plausible. That was worrisome. They agreed, the first time, even the first few times, that alert pilots found themselves circling in the rendezvous area with bombs aboard waiting for an execute or a return message, they would be strongly inclined to expect the worst, simply because it was the first time they had ever gotten that far. They would believe the war was on, or was imminent, because the commanders who had launched them without precedent would appear to have thought so. What if they had other reasons to think that as well? Suppose this launch came in a time of international crisis, either in the region or elsewhere in the world. Suppose there had been an earlier strategic warning of a heightened danger of war or attack. What if there was an actual war going on in the area, between China and Taiwan, or in Korea, or in Indochina, or a serious crisis such as actually occurred in 1954 and 1955, and again in 1958, soon after I wrote this memo, when the Chinese communists on the mainland spent months shelling islands a few miles offshore that were occupied by Chinese nationalist forces. In both these cases, there was presidential discussion of using U.S. nuclear weapons to repel an attack, or to